With me now is Donald Bogle, the author of an interpretive history of blacks in American film called Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks. His latest book, Brown Sugar, is a study of black female superstars from the past six decades. He's worked as a staff writer for Ebony and as a story editor for Otto Preminger. He grew up in the Philadelphia area and currently lives in Manhattan. He'll be speaking tonight at the Afro-American Museum. The subject of his talk will be Brown Sugar, the subject of his new book, and he'll also be screening the film Cabin in the Sky. This all begins at 7 o'clock this evening. It's free and open to the public, and it's at the Afro-American Museum at 6th between Arch and Race Streets. So that's at 7 o'clock tonight. Donald Bogle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Happy to be here.
Is it very, personally important to you to be going back and listening to recordings of black performers and screening movies in which black performers have been in? Is it a kind of personal mission in a way?
Well, yeah, actually, it is very personal for me. I've been very fortunate in some respects in that I was able to take a childhood passion, and I've been able to use it professionally. When I was growing up, I was addicted to movies and television. Maybe I saw a bit too much of both. But during the summers, I would go to the movies three or four times a week. And I can remember often in watching television and seeing old movies, I'd see something like the old Shirley Temple movies where you might see someone like Bill Bojangles Robinson. He's the black man who teaches Shirley how to tap dance up the magic staircase. I'd see Bojangles with Shirley, or I might see the old Charlie Chan mystery series where there was Birmingham Brown, the chauffeur played by Mantam Moreland. Or I might even see something like Gone with the Wind at a movie theater. And I often wondered, when I saw those movies, as a kid, I wondered, well, why is it that the black characters always disappear? They come on, they do a scene or two. I couldn't understand why the movies were not about Hattie McDaniel, who was Mammy and Gone with the Wind, why it wasn't about Eddie Rochester Anderson, who appeared in the Jack Benny movies of the 30s and 40s. So I was intrigued by all of that, and it was just something that puzzled me as a kid, and I wanted to know more. And then fortunately, later, I worked for a film director who had directed three black-oriented films. Otto Preminger had directed Carmen Jones with Dorothy Dandridge and Harry Belafonte. He'd also done Porgy and Bess with Dandridge and with Sidney Poitier. And he'd done a movie in the 60s called Hurry Sundown with Robert Hooks, Diane Carroll, Jane Fonda, Michael Caine, and others. And so when I worked for Preminger, I learned a lot about the movie industry itself. And later when I went to write for Ebony, that's when I really decided that I wanted to deal with film and with the whole business of image in America, black images. And I had many questions about the old stars I had seen on TV as a kid in old movies, Bojangles and Mantam Moore and the others. And I wanted to answer those questions for myself and to find out if I was right. And I thought I was right because I thought that the actors and actresses I was seeing were really very, very talented and gifted. I felt they played stereotype roles, but I felt that often they played those roles brilliantly and that they had transcended them. And that's what I wanted to thoroughly research and to discover if my intuitive sense was going in the right direction for me, and I think it was. And when I began to work on my first book, the main thing I wanted to distinguish was that black actors and actresses of the past and of the present played a role, and the role was often stereotyped. But at the same time, I wanted to separate the role from the performer. And I felt this had not been done in studying blacks in American films or in entertainment profession just generally. So I wanted definitely to do that, to look at the role, which was often demeaning, and then to look at the particular performer.
Now, how do you go about doing that, separating the two?
Well, you just look at them very closely and you try to see what's there. If you look at Hattie McDaniel in Gone with the Wind, she plays Mammy, the woman who sort of runs the big house. Here it is during the Civil War. She doesn't take up a gun and try to shoot Miss Scarlet. She's basically, they are supporting the dominant white culture. And, of course, for younger black audiences, looking at that, my generation, we often wonder, well, you know, why isn't she rebelling? But, of course, in terms of the script, she couldn't. But Hattie McDaniel herself, in terms of her own personality, she had a great deal of push and power. And she had this rich sonic boom of a voice. And when you heard Hattie McDaniel speak, you knew this was a woman you didn't mess with. And even Scarlett O'Hara, the character in the film, doesn't. There's a way that Hattie McDaniel, through gesture, through intonation, communicates in a way a certain kind of hostility. And you know that the script has her saying one thing, but she's saying something else. There's a sequence in Gone with the Wind where Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara gets into a wagon with Frank Kennedy, who's her sister's beau. I don't know if you remember the sequence or not. But her sister Sue Ellen is hoping to marry this man, and Scarlett wants to get money to pay the taxes on Tara. And so she begins to flirt with him. And we know that she's going to take her sister's boyfriend. We know, and the only other character in the film besides Scarlett who knows, is Hattie McDaniel's mammy. She's sitting in the wagon. And fortunately, the director of the film and David Selznick, the producer, they know to take the camera and put it on Hattie McDaniel. And we see that she's really annoyed and enraged by her mistress, who she really feels on equal grounds with, because she sees her doing something that Mammy feels is just morally reprehensible. So there the actress is communicating something to us that is not necessarily there in the script. She's aided by her director and her producer. I'll try to give you another example. There's a sequence in Sounder where Cicely Tyson goes into the local store to get food, and her husband has been imprisoned at this point. And the white storekeeper is rather hostile and hard on her. And Cicely Tyson, the camera comes in for a close-up, and of course we can see the veins in her neck, and we can see this woman who wants to speak out, but she really can't. And there is this anger and rage. Now Tyson, in the early 70s, by then movies had changed, so the camera moves in to show this. If you look at some of the old Step and Fetch It movies of the 1930s, there are scenes where Step and Fetch It might be pushed or shoved by his white master. And if you look closely at Stepan, you can see him sort of withdrawing into a self-protective shell. And you sense that he really does want to respond, but he can't, because of the whole racial codes. But the camera does not come in on a close-up for Stepan Fetchit. So the viewer has to sort of look at it and see what the actor or actress is doing. Rochester's another one. I mean, Rochester was a little bit different in that the scripts were good for him. He always was much wittier than Jack Benny, much more clever and much more resourceful. And we saw that here was the black servant who was really serving himself better than he was serving his master.
Were you able to speak with any of the performers who were forced into really stereotyped roles and talk to them about the discrepancies they felt between the world as they saw it and the world as they were forced
to portray it? Well, I did interview some of them, and one of my favorite interviews was with Mantan Moreland, who played Birmingham Brown, the chauffeur in the old Charlie Chan mystery series. And he had been through a lot in his career. He had been through a period in the 30s where he worked consistently, where he was enjoyed, and then he went through a period in the late 40s and 50s where it was felt that he had really been a sellout, and also in the 60s too. By the time I got to him in the 1970s, he was more relaxed, and things were going to change for him, and his work was eventually going to be evaluated in another way. But he said to me that in his day, many of the black actresses and actresses had come out of black vaudeville, where they were working in front of black audiences, and so the whole communication thing was quite different. When he got to Hollywood, then he found himself cast he's really operating in a white world, within the terms of the movie itself, and also in that the fact that these movies were viewed by large white audiences. So his work was not interpreted in the same way, and often, of course, it seemed as if he was sort of sucking up to his white master in his film. But Mantan said to me that in his day, no one thought seriously about the roles. The servant roles were really the embodiments of accepted social notions of the time. So people were really not that critical. And he went to work, and he tried to do it the best way he could. And there was definitely a professionalism there. Now, someone else like Freddie Washington was the black actress who appeared in the original Imitation of Life. She played the light-skinned black girl, Piola, who decides to pass for white. Freddie Washington was friendly with Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson was definitely a black political activist and quite outspoken about the roles that he played, and quite outspoken about racial bigotry and discrimination on screen and off, and he consequently was punished for that. But Freddie Washington was as well outspoken, and also she wrote articles and reviews, and she helped found the Negro Actors Guild. So some of the actors, you could appreciate them because of they had high standards in terms of giving a performance. And you understood that, of course, they did not grow up in the 60s or the 70s when people looked at all this much differently. Then others, you respected when you saw that they really had a lot of fight and bite, and that they also were forward-looking. They went beyond their period in a way, on a deeper level.
Did you ever go through a period in your own life where you resented them for helping to create roles that were embarrassing?
Actually, I never really felt that way. I think that with someone like Louis Armstrong, it was a long time before I really realized Louis Armstrong, that Satchmo was you know, an authentic American genius, because I'd see him, you know, with the handkerchief and sort of timing and so forth. He wasn't permitted often simply to play his horn and to go his way. Later on, I did discover that. So he was a figure, though, who it was difficult to approach. But with the others, I didn't know. I did see them as basically talented people who were sometimes up against a wall.
You've organized screenings of films with black performers in it and have shown them in a different context than the context that they were originally mm-hmm. screened in movie houses at film festivals and on college campuses. What kind of audience what kind of audience response is there? And what's the difference for you watching a film in that context?
Well, it's very interesting. In the 70s, the Student Museum in Harlem put on a black film festival, which I helped organize, and I lectured at the festival. And the museum was a bit concerned about what film to open with. And I suggested that the museum open with Stormy Weather. And this is an all-star film. It's an all-black film, a black film made in Hollywood, though. Lena Horne's in it, Bill Bojangles Robinson's in it, Cab Calloway, Catherine Dunham and her dance troupe. And we showed the film. Of course, I lectured before the movie was shown and just talked about black film history in general. I didn't say much about the film itself. The audience was just about all black. And the response was tremendous, because the black audience was seeing an all-black film where the black actors were not connecting to whites on screen. They were simply relating to one another, and there was a whole communal atmosphere that was there. And also, Stormy Weather doesn't have much of a plot. It's really a series of extraordinary entertainment acts, and the audience responded to the sheer talent that was up there. As a matter of fact, the audience was applauding. And was quite excited about the movie. So it was good to see that. And I found often that black audiences are sometimes more relaxed about the old movies when it is a predominantly black audience. Now, I saw one time, I went to see Casablanca at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And, of course, in Casablanca, Dooley Wilson plays Sam. And he plays on the piano as time goes by. He's wonderful in that. Of course, when I saw it, it was a sort of very young, hip, predominantly white audience. And when Dooley Wilson came on, the white audience started to hiss. And, of course, they were hissing the role. I mean, there's that famous line where I think Ingmar Bergman refers to him as boy or whatever. And the thing was that the audience, all right, so they may not like the role, but there's no way you can deny the power of Dooley Wilson when he sings that song. I mean, he conjures up a whole romantic atmosphere for all of us and contributes much to the mood and tone of that film without in any way degrading himself. He does play a kind of servant in that he is there to perform for the white world, but it's still a solid performance that we can respond to. But on occasion, some audiences, your supposedly more enlightened white audience feels it has to make some gesture against the racism of the past. Well, that's all right, but go a step beyond that. See the racism that's there, but also see something there that's very special and give the performer his due. The person you criticize is the screenwriter or perhaps the director or the whole system in Hollywood itself. But you try to give the actor or actress, if they're up there giving you something, then you give something back to them.
Do you notice a difference in the way different generations relate to the movies of the past? Because sometimes I think you need a certain amount of space between you and that performance in order to get to that next transcendent step.
Well, yes, I think that at this point, I think it's a little bit different. I think that the audiences are ready to respond in a different way. I mean, right now we have been through the typical 18-year-old of 1982 has grown up seeing on television the black sitcoms, Good Times or The Jeffersons or there was What's Happening or That's My Mama. And whereas audiences of the past in the mid and late 70s really had not grown up with that kind of thing. Years ago, there had been a TV series on the 50s called Amos and Andy, which had an extraordinarily talented group of actors and actresses, and it was taken off the air. Black audiences were somewhat resentful because the characters were all Toms and Coons and so forth. But this was the only kind of thing you saw on American television. The actors and actresses were very good. It's just too bad we didn't get a variety of images to select from. Nevertheless, that went off. Then the great irony of the whole situation, of course, is that in the 70s, mid-late 70s, all of these things come back on American television, and you get much more of it, but you don't get the kind of talent you saw before. But back to your question, the audience segment of the audience today has grown up with this and doesn't necessarily take it seriously, and therefore, when that segment of the audience sees an old film where similar kind of thing is going on in terms of stereotype, but the people are so much more skilled, then the audience now can respond in an entirely different way without necessarily feeling as hostile against the actors. I mean, I think that the audience still should think seriously about the role that's being played there.
Why do you think that television brought back and created new stereotypes for black families in the sitcoms?
Well, I think that what happened with American television was that the black sitcom of the 70s really grew out of the experience of the black-oriented movie of the early 70s, when there were movies like Shaft and Superfine. The film industry realized in the early 70s that there was a black audience. And the film industry never had even considered the black audience. And there was a black audience that wanted a kind of black product. Then the television industry realized the same thing. Also, Broadway for a while realized this. I mean, Broadway, at one point, you could see the black guys and Dolls. You could see The Wiz. You could see Billy Dee Williams was there and I Have a Dream. You could see For Colored Girls. So there was a lot of black input on Broadway during that period, too. So American television picked up on it. It was very, very hot at that time. It was going to make money. But instead of trying to deal with the black experience in a different way, halfway sensitive or intelligent way, the industry, as it is prone to do, picked up on a basic formula and basic types. And that's why we got those series we did. I mean, if you look at most of the mothers on those sitcoms, they are the old mammy figure. You talk about Louise Beavers or Hattie McDaniel, movies of the past. Most of the women on those sitcoms who played the mothers were brown-skinned black women. And brown-skinned black women in American films usually have not been permitted to be glamorous or excited or exciting or sexual. They usually are de-sexed and turned into these overweight, dowdy, mammy figures. And certainly this happened on American television with the women who played the mothers on those series, whether it's Esther Rolle in Good Times or if it's Mabel King in What's Happening. So television picked up on basic formulas and basic types. It was the easy way to do it. And just kept giving us that same thing. Once in a while, American television has given us something unusual. We get something like the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, or we get something like Roots, the first Roots, or the second Roots, Roots the Next Generation. Or even recently, something like the Maya Angelou thing that was on television. It's Sister, Sister, I think that's the, I confuse it with the play. It was called My Sister, I think. But that and also Melvin Van Peebles' Sophisticated Gents was, so on rare occasions, television gives us something else. But for the most part, television, in dealing with almost all experiences, sort of waters them down and takes the cliche trite way out. So, I mean, American television, it's trite to say it's the great American wasteland, but obviously it is. So all experiences are that way, but it becomes more acute with blacks in America, because at least with white images on the tidy screen, you have white directors, producers, writers, people from that culture giving you the experience. So it's easier for something real to come across. With the black-oriented shows, most of those, not all, but most did have white producers, directors, writers, people from an alien culture trying to say something about the black American experience.
Donald Bogle is my guest if you're just joining us, and he's written a couple of books. The latest is called Brown Sugar, and that's on the images of women performers, black women performers from the last six decades. His earlier book is on films, and it's called Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, and that's on the images of black performers in movies since the creation of film. In the 1970s, there was a term, black exploitation film, that was used to describe such films as the ones you alluded to earlier, like Superfly and Shaft, and films that mostly dealt with real studs and dealers and people who were really tough and macho. And that seems to have died out. There aren't films,
well,
it seems, with...
Well, there was a reason for those films. During the time they came out, many people were very critical of them, and I think the criticism was justified. But historically, there was definitely a place for those films. One of the great problems in American films is that there's the whole business of sex and racism in films. And in American movies, we very seldom got to see strong, defiant, sexual, aggressive black males. Many, many decades ago, D.W. Griffith gave us a movie called Birth of a Nation, where you did have sexually aggressive black men, most of whom were pursuing white women. And this was the idea that basically a sexual black man, all he wanted was a white woman. And, of course, this was the great white American nightmare. But Griffith's film was very controversial and criticized and banned, boycotted in a number of places. And afterwards, Hollywood feared dealing with sexual aggressive black male figures. So most of the black males you saw in American films were basically comic, non-threatening figures like a Stepan Fetchett or a Mantan Moreland or an Eddie Rochester Anderson. In the 1950s, it changed a little bit. You got figures like Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte. Now, these were men who were considered to be sexually attractive, but they were never permitted to be sexually aggressive in their movies. There's that very famous Poitier film of the 60s, A Patch of Blue, where there's the white girl who's in love with him, and he really can't, you know, he's sort of interested, but he can't make a move and all this other stuff. There's also Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, where, again, he's in, he's going to marry a young white woman, and there is no really romantic sequence in the movie. There's one scene where we really see them kissing, and that's through the rearview window of a taxi cab. Now, Poitier, in his movies, usually was the good Negro character. Poitier is a great actor. That can't be denied. But he had no more control over his screen image in the 50s than Bojangles had over his in the 1930s. So if you see him in a movie like The Defiant Ones, he and Tony Curtis play two convicts who escape from prison together. They're handcuffed together as they flee across the country. And then at the climax of the film, they're uncuffed. And Poitier, though, is made to really give up his freedom to come to the aid of his good white friend, Tony Curtis. If you see a movie like Edge of the City, Poitier and the white actor John Cassavetes are the best of friends. And at the climax of that film, Poitier is killed while he's trying to come to the defense of Cassavetes, and he dies in Cassavetes' arms. So his characters were the noble, self-sacrificing black male figures who really did not oppose the system. Now, Sidney Poitier, one of his most successful films was Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which came out in the 60s. And it was at this period, shortly after that he was jolted from his throne. There was a whole new audience growing up in the late 60s and early 70s. And this audience had witnessed incredible scenes every night in their living rooms in front of the TV sets. In the 60s and early 70s, there were, of course, the sit-ins, the boycotts, the demonstrations, a whole series of terrifying political assassinations. And there was the rise of black nationalism, cultural separatism, the Black Panthers, and the black audience yearned for a new type of militant hero in the movies. So the movies really changed because American society had changed. And one of the first to show up to really make it in films, the audience is so desperate for just about any kind of strong male figure it can get that it'll take almost anything it can get. And what did we get? We got Jim Brown. And Jim Brown, of course, was not a great actor, but Jim Brown did, because of his whole image from having played football and from having been really an extraordinary athlete, he represented for many violence, brutality, strength, power. So Jim Brown made it in films, but still, even in his movies, those early films of Jim Brown, you still didn't see the black man trying to take over, I mean, to really make a declaration of war on a tight, exploitative system. Later, Melvin Van Peebles, the black director, directed a movie called Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Gordon Parks Sr., another black director, directed Shaft. And Gordon Parks Jr. directed a movie called Superfly. And these three films were the groundbreakers. And it's interesting, they were directed by black males. They gave us the strong, aggressive, defiant black man who stomps down whitey. And he says he's not going to take it anymore. And the black audience needed that at that particular point. And those three films are really classics. Now, later, the film industry picks up on the basic formula, the strong black man, who is really sort of a Superman. And the industry begins to turn out just about every other week a new black-oriented film. Not only did we get Shaft, but we got Shaft's big score. We got Shaft in Africa. Not only did we get Superfly, we got Superfly TNT. Not only did Fred Williamson star in The Legend of Nigger Charlie, but he was in The Soul of Nigger Charlie, and he was in Boss Nigger. We got Slaughter 1, Slaughter 2, Hitman, Trouble Man. We were really getting the same movie week after week, and it wasn't a very good movie. And what happened was that eventually these films were being made by whites. They had black actors in them and black themes, but they basically were products of the commercial white film industry. Now, the black audience supported those films, but then the black audience wanted more, and the black audience, we certainly had a right to more. Once in a while, we got movies like Buck and the Preacher or Claudine or Sounder or Lady Sings the Blues, movies that tried to deal with another aspect of black life in America. But the black audience didn't get enough of that. And what really killed the black-oriented film was the film industry itself. Because instead of trying to come up with a new kind of product, the industry relied on the old formulas. When those stopped working, the industry really began to abandon the black-oriented film. For a while, there was talk of a movie that would appeal to white audiences as much as to black audiences. The industry then said that no film could make it unless it was a crossover film. And we'd seen that wasn't true. There was a black audience large enough to support its own films. Nevertheless, the industry stopped making the films. And today in the 80s, we're really back to the 1950s. In the 50s, the only black star who worked consistently was Sidney Poitier in American films, and the only one who works consistently in films today is Richard Pryor. It's sort of one at a time. And what's happened today also is that the black star of the 70s ends up being the supporting player in movies of the 80s. Billy Dee Williams in the 70s starred in Lady Sings the Blues and Bingo Long's Traveling All-Stars and Motor Kings. In the 80s, he ends up supporting Sylvester Stallone in Nighthawks, or he's with the Star Wars kids in The Empire Strikes Back. Pam Grier in the 70s starred in her own movies. In the 80s, she plays a supporting role in Fort Apache, the Bronx. So the 80s, in many respects, represent in American films a suppression of the race issue. And also, in a way, the black star discovers that he's lost his or her power in movies of the 80s.
You said that with the black films of the 70s, that the first wave was directed by black directors.
Yes.
And then those films got copied, and that ended up being in the hands of mostly white directors. When you go back and look at those movies now, can you see a difference in the way that the roles are interpreted?
Well, I think that if you see movies like those three films I mentioned, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, Shaft, and Superfly, there is such a high energy level there. It's interesting that the directors of those films realized they were onto something new, something different. And so they give it a different energy pull. And so there's still something a little bit startling about those particular films. They're also better made than the ones that follow. Now, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, it's there the black hero is really defiantly sexual. And there he rebels against the system. It's a very bloody movie in a sense, very, very violent. But it's a movie about a man who decides that he's going to triumph, and he's going to have the last laugh on the system, and the community in a sense aids him. The black community aids him in that triumph. So in that respect, it is different. The others that come along, often they're technically really shoddy. They look as if they were shot in someone's garage. The characters that have been new and fresh are now watered down, and there's none of that excitement on the part of the director or the scriptwriter that, you know, we're doing something else. So it's, you know, you get the idea that the people who worked on these movies, basically they just want to take the money and run back to the Hollywood Hills. So there is a difference in that respect.
Did you ever get to talk to Gordon Parks Jr. about what he thought of Superfly Looking Back? I remember at a theater in Philadelphia, there was a screening of Lead Belly, which he also directed.
Now, well, I'll tell you a bit about that in a minute.
Oh, okay.
They are confused. There's a senior, Gordon Parks Sr., maybe that's who you're referring to. Gordon Parks Sr. did Lead Belly. Gordon Parks Jr., the son, did Superfly. It often happens. People confuse.
Oh, okay.
Them.
Then he did Shaft?
Senior did Shaft and Lead Belly.
Okay.
Junior did Superfly. And I didn't talk to Junior. I have spoken to Senior.
Okay,
and
so Senior did Lead Belly.
Yes.
Okay, well, he was at the screening of his film when it premiered in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And he got up and spoke after the film and got a standing ovation from the audience. And he said, well, judging from the reaction that this film has gotten, I can say if the films get reaction like this, there won't need to be any more Shafts in the future. And I really never knew how to interpret that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something that's very interesting. Just a week ago in New York City at the American Museum of Natural History, Lead Belly was shown there. And I introduced the film and I spoke afterwards. And there was a tremendous turnout to see the movie. And the audience was, I would say the audience was about two-thirds white. And there were two showings and both packed. And the audience applauded at the end of this movie. Now, Gordon Parks Sr. had a number of problems with that film. The reason he got to make it was that he had a box office track record. He had done Shaft, which had been very successful. He'd done Shaft's big score. He'd done a movie called The Super Cops. But this was his movie in which he hoped to return to, in a way, the lyricism of an earlier period. Early in his career, he'd directed a movie called The Learning Tree, which was not a great success, but it's a movie that's often revived today. That one came out in the late 60s. And in Lead Belly, he was hoping to make a statement on a black man's life. It was quite a different film in that it was one of the few biographies, screen biographies, on a black figure. The only other major movie kind of thing like that I can think of is like Lady Sings the Blues on Billie Holiday. And it was also a film that tried to deal with a definite historical period, and the movie. I think that the film succeeds as entertainment. I don't really think it succeeds as a profound statement on Lead Belly's life.
It's very revisionist, isn't it?
In a certain respect, but
movies like that confuse me because they seem to want to really
deliver a portion
of history, but yet history is so rewritten in it that if you learned your history from the movie, you'd be confused.
The thing about it is that you. You never really sense in the movie this really oppressive, tight, outside, white world that enveloped Lead Belly. And you never really sense what the violence in his life stems from. But one thing that has to be said about the movie in that it was an attempt to do something else, whether it's revisionist history or whatever. It was an attempt to do something other than what Shaft did, and I certainly agree with you in that respect. But it... when it came out, the studio, Paramount Pictures, really was said to have lost faith in it, and they didn't think it was going to make any money. And Gordon Parks apparently was very upset about the way in which the movie was distributed. He didn't like the ad campaign on the film. And he had battles with the studio. And Lead Belly, the movie, was hardly a box office triumph. And I'm sure it was a very bitter disappointment, disappointing experience for Gordon Parks Sr. But one thing that I think that movie, I think that in terms of black images in American cinema, that whether it succeeds or not, the fact that it was a departure and from the standard fare of the day, that's what we need. We need more attempts to go in other directions. And if an artist succeeds one time and doesn't the next, then still he should be given that chance. Now, within the film industry, it's hard for any film director